Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Oh, so this is what it feels like. 2014, a new year, new blank canvas. I hope 2014 brings you all sorts of wonderful adventures and fortune and good health and happy coincidence and words as well. My year is going to be about words and literature, and so today's show seems a fitting start to that. We're off to immerse ourselves in poetry, exploring a new book that seeks to fuse poetry and herbs. Could make a good present. It's only 350 days until Christmas, you know.
Hey baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sound you ain't never seen the light before. Just a stone's throw from your front door.
I'm in the quietest place in London, I think. I'm in the Saison Poetry Library. Even the traffic seems to be keeping it down. In case you're not aware, the Saison Poetry Library is part of the Royal Festival Hall, which itself is part of the South Bank complex. And with me are poet Chris McCabe and herbalist and artist and publisher Maria Vlotideth. Hello, you both.
Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. We should explain why we're here. Primarily, we're here to talk about Pharma Poetica, which is a dispensary of poetry, a very beautiful object containing, well, just as it suggests, delicious poetry based around herbs and plants. But its setting today here in the Poetry Library is because, Chris McCabe, you're the manager here. And I thought it was a perfect opportunity, really, to look around a place that I think some people don't know about still, remarkably, and maybe to highlight what you do.
Yeah, we try our best to let people know kind of what we do here. We're the largest collection of contemporary poetry in the UK, so it's a unique resource. And as you said before, we're based at the heart of South Bank Centre, which is 21 acres of multidisciplinary arts. And at the centre of it, we've got this amazing collection of poetry going back to 1912. And it's also the place where Maria and I first met, and that set us off on our collaboration for Pharma Poetica.
Let's put a bit of a soft focus around the edges of the screen now, and we'll go back to that distant day when you first met each other. Can you tell us about that and how that meeting resulted in the work that is sitting here before us, Maria?
Well, I worked on a project called Pavement Poetry a few years ago, and although the book itself wasn't about poetry specifically, it was an art project with a sort of poetic concept at its heart, which was to put text on the streets of London, West London. I published a book on it and thought that the Poetry Library might be interested in having a couple of copies, so I came along with it. Spoke to Chris, and not only did he take two copies, much to my delight, but he was also a very interesting person. We got on very well, and in my mind planted the seed of starting to do another poetry collaboration, but possibly with him.
So. Yes, listener, it's a poetry love in here today.
I don't always hijack the publishers who come to sell books in the library, but as Maria says, you know, we had a really kind of interesting, fruitful conversation, and the Pavement Poetry Project really interested me because it was poetry in landscape. You know, it was very different from Pharma Poetica because it was urban. It was, you know, poetry in coal hole covers in the pavements in West London. So that was something which really excited my interest in what's often called psychogeography. you know, and certainly poetry in the landscape is something that is really a large part of South Bank Centre as well. I mean, just looking out the window, we can see there's a bridge there with a poem across the bridge, "We Measure Our Hearts," which is part of a big project bringing London poems from every borough to this particular part of London. And, you know, it's something which I'm interested in because I don't believe that poems necessarily begin and end on the page. And people's engagement with poetry that doesn't often fit into that really neat frame either. So pavement poetry was just a really interesting and innovative way, really, of getting poetry out to a different audience.
It's clear you share a belief in that respect. I'm wondering how you came upon that belief, whether it was something that was sort of built into the poetry that you read in younger days, or whether it was something you had to work your mind around too.
I think I've come to poetry through art. The idea of putting something in the landscape that you're not expecting or coming across, a bit like the amazing singing lift, I don't know if that's the right term, Chris, in this building. The first time I went into it, I thought of it as an act of poetry in itself, and that's not sounding too pretentious, but I didn't read that much poetry at school, and it's not something I've thought about consciously about doing, going through it through art terms. It's about bringing poetry to an audience that would be outside of the poetry world, so to speak. So with the pavement poetry, it was about putting work out there that, you know, would be seen by anyone or no one, but there wasn't a specific target audience. With this collaboration, Pharma Poetica, my interest in bringing a more scientific audience possibly to poetry, or an audience interested in botany or herbs or gardening. There's a rich tradition of using nature as an inspiration for poetry, as well as poetry in natural context, nature context rather than urban context. So for me, it was all about bringing different audiences to it.
Yes, just before we started the broadcast, we were working out what we should call everybody here. And we've come up with a long list, and we've hacked that down to, for example, for you, Maria, herbalist and artist and publisher. And I know there's a string of other things we can attach. Same goes for you, Chris. I wonder whether those issues around categorisation also obtain within your art. Are you able to define yourself as a particular kind of artist, or working in a particular media, or how does that work for you?
I don't categorise myself. I don't know, maybe it's something I don't think about enough, but or maybe I don't think it's that important. I like doing work in the public domain rather than within a gallery space. And I think it's combining different disciplines is also what's interesting, because you get to explore the gaps that sometimes, you know, things fall outside and therefore are left empty, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And likewise, you know, from a poetry perspective, there's a great quote from Ezra Pound where he said, "Publishing a volume of poetry is like throwing a leaf down a canyon and waiting to hear the echo." And it becomes frustrating after a while, you know, when you realise where the limits of the art form are, you know, whether it's visual art or language art. You know you're going to be delivering to the same people, the same audience, the same faces, you know, and there's a limit to the outreach of that. Whereas when you take the edges off, there's a great fluidity and a great possibility that you're going to connect with different people in different ways. And that's really what excited me about working with Maria, and more broadly about poetry off the page, is that, you know, if people who aren't necessarily interested in poetry, that's fine, but we're all kind of bound by language, and we're all aware of the possibilities through language, and it's when you start kind of taking off the frame of the page that people connect in ways that might not have been expected for them.
Or the boundaries, are taken down, because I think there's a lot of boundaries around art and poetry and herbal medicine. All those three things have sort of issues around them that people are resistant towards. So I think by changing the context in which they're framed, it does allow people to sort of teeter towards it in a way they might not otherwise want to. And going back as well to the publishing element to what I do, I treat that very much as an art work in itself. Publishing now is changing so much anyway. It's become much easier for individuals to publish work because of the printing costs being reduced. But at the same time, publishing is going through this sort of digitization. And so for me, it's very much creating something that still, as an object, is can be touched and felt and seen a bit more as a work of art. So that's what's interesting.
The copy of Pharma Poetica we've got here, it's now I'm going to call this double gatefold and immediately decide that I'm wrong.
No, that sounds right, but I'm not very technical.
I think in albums of old, I think that's how it worked with the vinyl. On the front cover here, we've got a big, beautiful glass jar, one of those old Victorian pharmacy.
Apothecary jars.
Yes, and inside it's some sort of herb going on. Now, is the poetry medicinal here?
I don't believe poetry should be offered as medicine, because we all know from our childhood experiences that things offered on a spoon are quite quickly spat out. So I think the argument that art is good for you, it will cure you, it'll make you feel better, it'll offer some kind of balm to existence, is often something that people renege against. It's fabulous when people connect with it in that way and they do feel those benefits, but I wouldn't brand it as such.
We were talking about the closed audiences, almost closed audiences, potentially, if poetry exists just within the pages of books of poetry, and there's that sort of, there can be that psychological barrier, that psychological bar to entry. You use the word pretentious, Maria. What are the issues there? Because I think some people do see poetry as perhaps intimidating, and therefore it's easy to tag it with the label of pretension. I think there are some silly people in the poetry world who only add to the idea of it being pretentious. How do you break down that misconception?
I think, I mean, a fact, everyone comes to poetry at some point in their life. It's usually around a birth, a death, or a funeral. You can't...
You mean Hallmark cards, of course.
Well, I'm Purple Ronnie, you know, let's not forget him. You know, so at the Poetry Library, you know, a service we offer, it's a not quite a daily, but certainly a weekly thing, is people say, I'm going to get married, a child's just been born, someone I love has just died, I need to find the words, which I can't find myself, to mark this occasion, this life occasion, this event. And people will come to poetry and they will look for the words which fill in the space which they can't quite feel themselves, but you know, that's a response, that's a kind of guttural instinct from the person that they need those words at that particular point. There's nothing pretentious about that. It's a need, you know, it's a need to express, it's a need to mark, it's a need to define. I think, like most art forms though, you know, it's kind of the Beatles started off with 2 minute pop songs and ended up with the White Album, you know, kind of, you know, once you're in the art, you want to find out what's possible within the art, and obviously, you know, poets are good at kind of pushing and pushing and pushing until it's a form which maybe means a lot to other poets, but not that so much to the rest of the world, which you can expect in every art form.
And the word pretentious, the way I used it, it's quite subjective. Well, I guess what words are, but you know, what's pretentious to somebody isn't pretentious to somebody else. And I think sometimes that that anxiety over pretension can get in the way of being more open-minded. Nowadays, I don't know, so much is about the self and about marketing and about all the sorts of things. So in a way, one could say that is sort of pretentious in itself. It's all about pretense. We are all pretending to do something or be somebody else through these different sort of interfaces. So maybe one should just put it to one side and explore things
quietly. It's the pressure to wrap things up, I think. You know, it's once you come up with a project, I mean, it was quite an amorphous idea that we had, you know, around herbs and poetry and how that would be contained, and then you kind of get to the stage of how are we going to explain it to people, how are we going to present it to people, how are we going to sell it to people, you know, how are we going to get people to the event. And you know, you need, unfortunately, you need a title, you need a bit of copy, you need you know, a good argument that it's a worthwhile thing for people to engage with.
Are you yourself when you write poetry?
I am most myself when I write poetry, but I'm probably speaking to somebody who doesn't exist, which is kind of, for me, that's the bigger conversation. Like, who are you writing for? Is there one person in mind? Is there an audience in mind? You know, is it an ideal person, an ideal reader? You know, I've never quite defined. I think I've got a number of different people that I would like to listen to different kinds of poems that I write, and I've never quite kind of worked out who that audience is.
But you're you in the sense that it's your, not just your voice, but your persona.
Yeah, you know, I think I've been writing poetry for so long, it's kind of, it's such an integral part of my kind of being, if you like. You know, I think in poetry in the sense of the music of the words. You know, I often carry bits of poems around with me before writing them down, and you know, that becomes quite an odd experience, because when you're making a cup of tea, you're not making a cup of tea, you're kind of working on a poem. You know, when you're waiting at a bus stop, you're not waiting at a bus stop, you're working on a poem. So it's difficult to say, this is real me, not real me. You know, it's kind of all part of just being and thinking and me, you know, kind of justifying the points of being here, really, you know, which we all have to do at various points.
This is one of the daily battles I have on the home front, when I'm busy making a cup of coffee and I'm interrupted by my partner, and she can't possibly understand that I'm working on my novel at the moment. Understandably, perhaps.
Breakthrough moments over a Nescafe, yep, we've all been there.
Curator Maria, could you select a poem for us, please, for Chris to read?
Well, I mean, I think we're going to start with one of Chris's poems, not in the book. Chris worked on another project before we started our collaboration, and that was part of the Urban Physic Garden, I believe, in Southwark. They commissioned an anthology of poetry by various poets called Herbarium, and it was just coincidental that Chris was working on this when I came up with the idea of getting him to write poems about herbs that I was going to throw at him, sort of ideas and notes and things. So I don't know, I think maybe we'll start with a poem, his poem, which is on nettles, one of my favourite plants. And then we'll talk about which poems we'll read from the book.
Yeah, and this book, Herbarium, is a limited book. At the Poetry Library, we've got a couple of copies, but it was limited to 100 copies. And by the time all the poets got the copy, you know, their own copies, there's about possibly around 60 poets in here, and they were all given a herb to write on. And I chose nettles, which really, you know, kind of set the landscape really for the Pharma Poetica project, because through this poem I wanted to see the herb and experience the herb through my son, who at the time was about 3, and in a very straightforward way, he was, you know, closer to the earth, he was, you know, closer to the ground, and he was coming into language as well. So I think through all these poems there's a sense of him arriving in the world and me trying to arrive at an understanding of the world, and these herbs, which I'd not really thought about in any great detail. I realised I had a lot of cultural associations with herbs and a lot of poetry that had been written in my head around herbs already, but, you know, from a scientific perspective, Maria was setting me off on all kinds of explosions of knowledge which I'd never really considered before. So I wrote this poem, Nettles, for the Herbarium book. You know, I'd never actually thought of nettles as a subject for a poem before, but the closer I looked at them, true of all these poems really, the more I realised that you know, there was a kind of whole microcosmic world within the you know, the thing itself. So, nettles, stinging hairs there as not there, the light around your mouth in bars, late ambers play tricks. Do you know the trouble this could cause? It hurts for hours afterwards, like mentally what I do to myself. A doc leaves apocryphal, or are we talking prescriptions? The hairs around your mouth and jawline, softer than threads and without essences or legacies. The danger is in what they could make me do. The stamen of a tongue, the remembered spoken lumps under skin for decades. How do you explain to a boy of 3 who's never been stung that just to touch green so soft will rash away his happiness? Without permission, he disbands school shorts, passes water in the triffid shoots until the cod bone bristles disappear. To explain how something that isn't there can sting is like his first symposium on the metaphysical heart. Hairs so faint on a desirous tongue that went ways outside of eagerness to first furrow for taste. Then there was someone else stood small in the green-scented room. Someone who blots up the time it would take us to kiss. He sings. The words he speaks in our breath balms the absence, as dock leaves do stings.
That was magnificent.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, that really just set us off, didn't it? So I'd written this poem, and Maria had the idea for Pharma Poetica, you know, 10 poems about herbs.
with the constraints that the idea was for the poem not to exist, as we spoke about at the beginning, on the page, but to exist as a label on a jar, which would contain a specimen of the plant or medicinal plant that it was about. And this was something I was inspired by, a jar that I'd seen in Book Art Bookshop, which I now subsequently, at the time, didn't know who had done it or who the author was, but I've now discovered it was Alec Finley, which ties in quite nicely to the Pavement Poetry Project, also referencing a lot of Ian Hamilton Finley's work. But my constraint then for Chris was to write a poem that would fit on a label, that would fit on the jar. So there was, again, a bit like Pavement Poetry, a physical constraint to the amount of words or letters that could fit in a certain space. So it was quite a challenge, I think, to write something that would, would fit in a small, on a smaller label.
And I set myself a number of constraints in addition to that as well. I decided I was going to write the poems, 10 poems in a week. I was going to Cornwall with my wife and son on a holiday, and that was my constraints, if you like. I was going to write the 10 poems in 7 days. And within that, I didn't feel I had to find the herb to write the poem. The experience of looking for the herb should hopefully possibly be enough to enact the kind of excitement in language to make the poem happen. So I went away and I wrote these poems in 10 days, and it was, you know, it was not always straightforward, you know, certain things that I couldn't find. Absinthe, for example, you know, a lot of the herbs that I had to find in alcoholic drinks, unfortunately. I had to go to the bar and...
What a chore.
Yeah, it was a tricky weekend. You know, the very last...
So, let me get this straight. You've gone on holiday with your wife and boy, and you're off down the pub. Oh, it's for poetry, darling.
Yeah, of course. It's all in the name of art. You know, that was... on the last day, for example, I had one poem to write on absinthe.
Wormwood.
Wormwood.
You drank the absinthe.
Exactly. So I was in the disco on the holiday camp, and I thought, when am I going to find wormwood at this, you know, this stage of the evening in Cornwall in a holiday camp? I thought absinthe, obviously, you know, there's a whole history of poets kind of taking wormwood in through that route. So I went to the bar and got the funniest look I think I've ever had from anyone when I said, "Have you got any absinthe?" I was just kind of sent packing, but you know, the whole experience was enough for a poem to happen.
And how are things at home now?
I live by myself now, I don't really. The book's, you know, a kind of container in itself of that experience as well, which is what I'm really fond of, and what my wife and son are really fond of. You know, it's like we kind of wrapped up the holiday in this book. You know, the landscape, it's quite outdoorsy, far more poetic. I think a lot of the landscape came into the book, and I really enjoy that.
Can we hear that poem?
Yeah, let's hear that one. It's not the last in the book, but it's the last one that I wrote. It references a number of different things in the disco. So Party in the Dark was a game that the kids were invited to play. My son had a glow stick, you know, one of those kind of snap glow sticks that kind of you dance with and they light up on the dance floor. And a number of songs came into the poem as well that were being played by the DJ. Wormwood. For Party in the Dark, this is the herb. The first CCTV was absinthe with the worm in. It followed you around the room. Now the boy has a glow sword. It works by snapping to a light stick. Full glow can take a few minutes. Do not drink or digest. If I could work this out, I'd be a symbolist. The song runs, I'm a little yellow fish in the deep blue sea. Won't somebody save me? The next, big fish, little fish, cardboard box. Between Party in the Dark and Rock and Roll Bingo, I ask at the bar, do you have any absinthe? Answer, no. We are parents. We have a boy. The last drug we took was at his birth.
The companion piece to that poem is the picture in the other half of the book, and it's got a picture of the jar with the poem on it and some information about Wormwood itself, I presume. And let's step away from poetry completely for a moment. I'd love to talk about the herbal side of things, because that, of course, deserves its spot here too.
Well, the picture that you mention is taken from the art piece itself. So Pharmapoetica, I don't know if we made that clear, but it started as an artwork rather than a book, and it's a cabinet, a medical cabinet, full of 10 jars with the labels, the poetry labels and the herbs inside. And I liked what Chris was just saying now about the book containing the nature and his holiday, because each of these jars are also containing nature in that sense. So there's different plant specimens that came from different places. I think the wormwood I purchased because it was quite a difficult plant for me to find and to dry and cultivate. But some of the other specimens in the other jars, like on the front cover, for example, we've got St. John's wort, and that was a cutting given to me by somebody in Greece. On the back of the book, there's cutting of bay leaves, which I took from outside my front door. The daisies on the inside flap were collected in Regent's Park and Hyde Park and very patiently dried.
So there's still that psychogeographic element in the collection of the... I have to ask, what's the difficulty with wormwood?
Well, there's not that much difficulty. I guess I was on a bit of a time scale. And also, in London, it's not that easy to come across. And I think it's traditional use as an abortifacient, which it would have been because it has quite a strong action on the uterine muscle due to its bitterness. It's one of the most bitter herbs that we have. It's something that people don't necessarily cultivate and has sort of like element around it that's not exactly taboo, but there's an element to wormwood which its relationship to absinthe and the in large doses its hallucinogenic actions. But I just didn't get a chance to find that much in London. But I was trying to find the herbs myself within a certain area around where I lived so that I could put that, or brought them back from Greece, which is where my father's from. So,
what's life like as a herbalist?
It's fun. Being a herbalist has lots of different. I'm a clinician as well as a teacher. I think there's lots of different guises in which to be a herbalist. But you're definitely living on the fringes of the medical establishment, if not completely outside of it. So
I'm just trying to picture what your what a day as a herbalist might consist of. And you say a clinician, so you're in an establishment of some sort, dishing out advice?
Yeah, most herbalists practice in therapy centres. So you would see a client or patient take a history and prescribe herbs for them mainly through tinctures, alcoholic extracts, which you can then blend to suit and tailored to suit the patient and their particular condition. But it's not giving a herb in the way that you'd give a drug. It's not just about tackling one symptom, or you're prescribing for the whole person. So no two people with eczema have the same prescription, really, because they've got other things going on, and some might have a hotter eczema or cold eczema. Again, this sounds quite a medieval way of looking at it, but the idea is that you're looking at the individual and in their entirety and helping them with herbs and diet and lifestyle advice and all sorts of things. So it's a sort of all-rounded approach to health. But it doesn't mean that herbalists are anti-drugs or anti... there's a place for everything, and I guess it's just one particular approach which I feel comfortable with and I like because of that connection with nature.
We should go from your one of your many lines of work to Chris. I don't know whether to call it the secondary or the primary or who cares, but the poetry library that we're in now. Should we begin to have a look around?
Yeah, why don't we? So we're in the library now and we're looking out over South Bank Centre, and significantly we can see the rooftop garden, which is just above the Queen Elizabeth Hall, and it's a wonderful, quite a new place which has been created for people to come and enjoy a kind of natural landscape in the centre of London. And Maria and I have enjoyed a glass of Pimm's up there during the summertime, talking about our project. A lot of the herbs that we've written about are in there as well, and that gives you an idea of how unexpected really it is at South Bank Centre. And coming into the poetry library can be a little bit like that. People think, what is this place? There's a library. What kind of library? A poetry library? What is a poetry library? It's a kind of amazing thing even to imagine could exist, a library which is just poetry. So
I've got to say, as well, as a writer, I use this resource myself a lot, and you've got your finger on the pulse of smaller publications, which is a lifeline for a lot of writers.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. We collect between 200 and 300 items a month. That's a lot of poetry. That's mainly UK published items, and that can range from limited edition broadsides and pamphlets to obviously magazines is a big part of what we do. There's about 180 poetry magazines currently in the UK alone. And then we collect up books and DVDs. We're standing next to the audiovisual collection here. We have DVDs and CDs. You know, it's a lot to be collected, and it's a real vibrant scene of activity, which, you know, often takes place in people's bedrooms, you know, in pubs, and you know, in conversation, right the way up to big publishers like, you know, Faber and Faber and Blood Axe, who are getting books out to bookshops. And one thing that people really enjoy about the library is one of the things I enjoy, which is it feels like a neutral space. You know, there's like most art forms, there's divisions, and there's different ideas of what it should be doing and how people should be interacting with the art. Well, you come to the Poetry Library and you just get the way it is rather than the way it should be.
Yes, there's one element to writing in the present day which is highly performative, isn't there? And it seems, and I'm not making a judgment one way or the other, but it seems that it's heavily influenced by boozy nights, and you've got to have a particular sort of personality to want to get up on stage in front of people and read your stuff out. And it changes how one consumes the art form if it's being performed rather than read at your own speed on the page. So to know that there's a place where quiet contemplation is possible, not that we're allowing it to be quiet at the moment doing this interview, but a place where contemplation and engaging with the text on a sort of a one-to-one level, if that's what you want to do, or to see and hear one of the poets who you've got on file here and maybe repeat that performance as many times as you want by replaying it, that's really quite a special thing.
Yeah, it is. And just to flip that over as well, it is all those things, and that's what's wonderful about the library. But it's also a place for those people who are into performance, who loves the stage, who want to know what the history of slam poetry is, you know, its roots in dub, for example, and poets like Lincoln Kwesi Johnson. We have all those books here. We have the CDs here and DVDs.
Oh, so it's not just poetry, it's books about poetry, yeah, and the practice as well.
We have books about poetry, we have press cuttings, so if you've got a particular poet or movement in poetry you're interested in, we will have taken clippings from newspapers over a long period and put them together in one file, and you can ask for that file and you can see kind of, you know, things from The Guardian 10 years ago which were written about a particular poet. So that's a really unique resource, and that applies to whatever kind of poetry you're into. You know, I think sometimes we should be talking about poetries rather than poetry, because, you know, whether the whole diversity that happens within the art can be contained in that one word is kind of up for discussion, I think.
We've got the herb, I think, Pharma Poetica herbs. You've got Bush Telegraph will be the title for the shrubs and bushes book, and then Poet Trees. You can have that for free.
Yeah. I'll leave that with Maria.
Something you better add. Shall we move around the place and see what's here?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're just walking past the exhibition space that we have, and we've got a current exhibition by the artist Kenneth Wynne-Evans, and we're really delighted that he created some new work for us for our 60th birthday, which happened this year. And he's created this incredible vinyl poem, which he was very, very adamant that we should be in a semi-transparent vinyl. So it's about stars being discovered in the 60s, or people thinking that new stars have been discovered in the 60s, but actually there were specks of dust on the lens, and these things were named and all the rest of it, until people realised that they weren't actually out there in the stratosphere at all. You know, just needed to wipe the glass. So to reflect that short poem, which I think it is a poem, he's written, he wanted it in a kind of semi-transparent vinyl, so you can only see certain words at given times. And a company that he's created some text-based pieces, which are kind of abstract expressionist meets concrete poetry pieces, really nice black paint slapped onto the canvas, and then he's punctured the page with the alphabet, actually cut out the alphabet in the canvas as well.
I mean, what we're seeing here is the alphabet. That can't be called a poem, can it?
It's a work of art, and really, you know, what I think what we're looking at is the idea that language and each letter within the alphabet is first and foremost a visual sign. And I think we take it for granted after a while that language is something which is a given, and it's a code that we all understand, and we don't really look at the shape of the letters anymore. So I think what Kenneth's inviting us to do whilst having paint on the canvas with the letters, is to say, well, what's visual and what isn't? You know, when a letter A is presented in the lowercase and it curls at the top and puts its belly out in the middle, and the letter B and D face each other back to front about the same sign. You know, what do those letters actually say in themselves, regardless of how they sound or how they make up words?
So we're over to Vae Richards and the shape of a text, denoting what sort of text it is. This is dangerous territory.
It's a bit like typography having a speech. Or I like the idea that, you know, depending on what typeface you use, the words can create a different sound. And going back to Pharmapoetica, we were discussing what typography to use for the poetry. And in the book, because we've got an image of the label and the jar as well as the printed poem, we've used two different typefaces for that, which I like the fact that you can see both of them and read them in a way both differently because of the typefaces. So, you know, what you were saying about the visual signs being different and therefore speaking differently.
Yeah, and it's the given of typography, you know, certain fonts which are used almost universally for certain things. Why is that the case? You know, it's just become a custom. You know, when you open a Word document and it just defaults to Times New Roman, it's a pretty awful font. You know, it's kind of antiquated. It's not quite difficult to read, but we're all using it. You know, and then someone puts a sign up in a public space, they kind of are going to do that in Comic Sans. You know, Comic Sans can be wiped off the face of the earth. It's such an awful invention.
Let's move further into the Saison Poetry Library.
Londonist Out Loud is sponsored by Audible. To claim your free audiobook from a range of 60,000 titles, try the Audible service on 30-day free trial. Audiobooks can be saved as MP3s and played on your compatible phone, tablet, or desktop, or burned to CD, and they're yours to keep. For your free audiobook, go to www.audible.co.uk/Londonist and click through.
I'm with Chris McCabe and Maria Vlotideth, and we're in the heart of the Saison Poetry Library at the Royal Festival Hall. And Chris, who's moonlighting as the manager here, really he's a poet, but this is his other line. And we're having a look at what's going on in the poetry. Can we go to the heart of the collection?
Yeah, why don't we? So we're just walking past the loan collection, and the library's quite unusual in that we have two copies of everything, which means people can come and join free of charge, and they can borrow books from the library. Like they would do at the public library, but we always keep a copy in the library for research purposes, which means if people come from a long distance and they want a very specific thing, that copy will always be here. And I'm just going to walk us up to the rolling stacks, because this really is one of the defining features of the library. I think people really love these rolling stacks. They allow us to get a lot of books into a small space, because only one person can get in at any one time, and it's a daily kind of hazard, really. You know, people will try to move them all along, and there's someone in there, and you know, the whole kind of thing goes up in flames, and we sort it out, and then it happens an hour later. And a poet, Chrissy Gittins, actually wrote a poem, Death in the Poetry Library. So she was imagining, you know, that the worst had happened.
Who would have thought there could be so much peril here?
Well, it's a dangerous art, you know. It's everyone knows it, you know, poets disappear young and move to faraway places and never return, you know.
Well, not that far away, we know where a few of them probably are.
Yeah, that's it. We keep them in the library as part of our archive. I can move these along and show you how they work if you like. So what we've got here, about 12 shelves with a wheel attached to them, so they look a little bit like, people describe them a bit like, you know, kind of a ship steering wheel or something like that. And it says, going back to talking about typography, you know, it says, not as clearly as we maybe should have it, please check aisle is clear of people before moving shelves, because if you don't, they'll start to move along quite quickly, and they're really, really heavy, and it opens up another shelf of books. And
now, what I noticed there was that you didn't check the aisle next to that in case there were people there.
Well, what happens is after a while you develop this sixth sense, and you can just tell kind of if anyone's in there or not. It's quite a talent.
And where do we go from there?
We could have a look at the magazine collection, which is just reflective of the vibrant scene in poetry. We've got about 180 current magazines from the UK, and I show this to people who churn out that old argument, you know, isn't poetry dead, you know, it's an obsolete art form, you know, nothing's happening anymore. I just bring them to look at these magazines and say, well, look, these are all current magazines, these are the latest issues of magazines, and it reflects the diversity of the art, different kinds of poetry, different kinds of publication. And what I love about them is that really the titles of them, because people who make magazines are often poets or the people who love poetry and playing around with language. So we've got magazines like the Dark Horse, Obsessed with Pipework, Gutter magazine. It's quite a good one. My favourite's actually in the archives, which is called Strange Feces, and that disbanded in the 70s, unfortunately.
There's an easy joke I could reach for. I'm going to leave it.
Just leave it. And between the magazines, we've got Dylan Thomas, a bust of Dylan Thomas, which was created by a sculptor in the 50s called Hugh Olof DeWitt. And it's a really wonderful capturing of Dylan Thomas. I think his head rests upon his tie, and he looks like he hasn't slept for a few days. It looks like he's
very rumpled.
He's had whiskey for breakfast, and there's a cigarette kind of coming at the corner of his mouth.
We were at the Guildhall Library not so long ago, and I was asking Dr. Peter Ross, who's in charge there, how he goes about finding items for his collection. And I was surprised, really, to discover that it's all done by people doing personal investigations, as opposed to there being some big computerised system for finding stuff. It's a very sort of touchy-feely, personal way of finding individual titles. A lot of these magazines appear for just a few editions and then perhaps might disappear again. And I've always been impressed that you managed to get hold of those as well. How do you do that?
It's exactly as you say, really. It's word of mouth. It's people, users coming into the library asking for certain things. If we haven't got it, we'll get it. It's people who create the magazines, you know, coming to us saying, I've just set up a poetry magazine, will you subscribe? And one of the good things about the library is we do subscribe. We like to support poetry publishers, so we're not like the British Library, which is great in all manner of ways as well, but we are not a deposit library, so we pay publishers for the things that we want to collect. And likewise, you know, we do spend some time scouring around. If a member of staff spots something and says, oh, we've got to get this, we've got to get that, but it's an absolute minefield, because when these magazines fold, nobody tells you that they're folding, you know. They'll just say, I'm not doing it anymore, and then we'll never have that kind of notice from them that, you know, I'm not going to do the Dark Horse anymore or the Gutter. It's just something we have to find out through time. So it's what makes it an amazingly exciting and vibrant collection to have. But it's also, you know, its difficulty as well is that it's a movable feast, and it's hard to actually catalogue and keep on top of in that sense.
So this impulse of yours, Maria, to come in and bring copies of Pavement Poetry was exactly the right thing to do. This is an interactive process by the sounds of it. And I'm conscious that over behind us there we've got people in booths. What's going on there? They're in booths with reading lamps. Is this a bit of research going on here?
I would have thought so. It's a great place to come to think, to read and to write. We have a lot of poets who use the library. John Hegley once came along, wrote a poem and left it on the table, forgot it and disappeared, you know. So I think sometimes just the idea of being here is more important than what you actually do, you know. It's a kind of wonderful place just to come and get away from everything, you know. And you can look out the window and you can see the traffic flying past on Waterloo Bridge and people dashing to work and the commuter rush and all that, and you feel somehow away from it.
I'm feeling terribly guilty because we're talking about how it's a quiet place for people to get away, and we're making a racket here. I'm feeling like we should drift off, say goodbye to Dylan for a moment.
Londonist Out Loud is available free as a stream at londonist.com or a weekly download via iTunes. Hit us up on Facebook at Londonist Out Loud, tweet at Londonist Sound, and check out images of our guests via the Londonist Out Loud stream on Instagram.
Hawthorne. There is no hawthorn on these clifftops. I want to soothe your heart even when the words aren't for you. I offer this antioxidant to your anxieties as a cardiac tonic for winter deliriums. My mind's May blossom for the lovesick. Do you want to link me to death? We have, both of us, chronic heart failure. The rose that stabs you is your own organ. There are hawthorns, I'm told, in the new Hockney exhibition, but you have to pay to see them. Better the welcoming hedgerows in Regent's Park, though we'll never blossom, you know this, so far north of the river's black aneurysm.
Hawthorn, Crataegus monogyna, or Laevigata, or Oxyacantha, there are lots of different botanical varieties of hawthorn that herbalists use. We use the berries and the flowering tops of the plant. I chose to include this plant in my herb sketches for Chris because it is commonly seen in England, is widely used by herbalists, and has folklore and magic attached to boot. A member of the rose family, it also has thorns, hence hawthorn, rose having an affinity for the heart. These plants are indicated whenever the heart is affected, either physiologically, heart failure. Hawthorn would have been used for dropsy, a historical term for when too much fluid accumulates in the ankles due to poor heart pumping action, or emotionally, broken-hearted, grief. Unsurprisingly, hawthorn is linked to death. Its flowers were thought to smell of death and were thus a taboo to bring indoors. My first unknowing encounter with hawthorn was through watching the 1967 film Camelot. It's May, the lovely month of May, sings Vanessa Redgrave as Guinevere. Hawthorn, a.k.a. May Blossom or Mayflower, was used to decorate the maypole for the pagan festival of Flora, symbolising fertility. However, hawthorn, as mentioned, is more of a herb of the heart than of the loins, and one could interpret its, the appearance of its blossoms as the blossoming of love. The flowering tops, buds and leaves, and autumn berries are used by herbalists as cardiac tonics, strengthening the heart and easing palpitations. They are suitable for the lovesick, the love delirious, and those suffering from grief as well as heart failure. Much research has and is being done on the various compounds in hawthorn, the oligomeric procyanidins, flavonoids, phenolic acids, for their hypertensive and antioxidant effects, as well as their actions in slowing the heart muscles while increasing their contractility. Hawthorn grows both as a tree and a hedge, haw being the old Saxon word for hedge. If you want to collect the flowers and young leaves to make a herbal infusion, welcoming hedgerows can be found lining parts of Regent's Park. I remember my teacher telling me the best way to take hawthorn is to nibble the fresh leaves off the tree once they start appearing in spring, which sort of appealed to the goat in me. I also remember seeing two hawthorn trees on a walk in Northumberland that were entwined in an embrace as if they were lovers. It was most spectacular and spooky at the same time. No wonder Greek myths included mortals being turned into trees.
Marvellous. Wow. And I love the juxtaposition. I mean, that's the first time we've heard the two pieces juxtaposed in that way. We're coming to the end of our time, but I have to ask in just a moment, I think, about the dangers of becoming a herbalist, because it seems to me that there are some occupations and or pastimes that you could undertake on an amateur level with a relative degree of safety, but this ain't one of them. So I'd be interested to know about that journey. But another journey is going to be going on, hopefully, which is the art exhibit of the jars that form the basis of Pharma Poetica. What's the story there?
We were planning to show the cabinet with the poetry in various public places so that people could come across and read poetry as if it was written, you know, on a sculptural piece. So we've got various places in mind, whether they're inside one particular place, possibly the Royal College of Physicians or the Museum of Pharmacology, but also taking it on the road to various festivals where we can do poetry readings around it as well.
Yeah, and, you know, that warning, the hazard, you know, that you suggested should be observed by all people, you know. There are poems presented as medical labels. I'm not a doctor, but I do have a few ideas of my own.
There's something about that look in your eye that worries me, sir.
That's it. You know, it's a twinkle. You can't take it out, I'm afraid.
to bring us to the close, how did you find your way into this whole business, Maria?
Initially, I think through my family, my mother's German, and in Germany, using herbs within the family for minor ailments is very a common occurrence. So I was always sort of plastered with arnica cream or given chamomile tea. So it was something that I found was very familiar to me. And my father, who's Greek, his mother would also always suggest herbs to me from the garden if I had sort of stomach cramps or things like that. So the idea of being able to source your own medicines from the outside world and then to transform them alchemically into something that would help you and heal you always appealed to me as an idea. But I never really knew that there was such a thing as being able to study herbal medicine. I always found myself when traveling in gravitating towards various botanical gardens and being completely fascinated by different plants with different labels. Again, the Latin names, also something very kind of poetic and alchemical about that. What lay underneath these plants, and why what was the magic within them? And I decided to train partly through that, for that interest, and because it's of the fact that it's marrying both human biology and physiology and the communication and understanding of human beings as well as the natural world. It's two things that blend beautifully together. So I studied it for 3 years. It's a 3-year degree, although now with all the different changes in the student fees, I think it's a course that's slowly becoming extinct, unfortunately, and is taught mainly on a much more amateur level to those who are interested. But it's not an easy life being a herbalist, because there's not that much acceptance of it within our culture compared to other cultures in the world. I mean, in China, going to hospital there, you're just as likely to be given a herbal tea as you are a drug, and they integrate it very much. It's very much side by side treatment, whereas here it's considered either something completely medieval or hippie-ish or alternative or dangerous or politically threatening in some way, because it isn't as evidence-based as people would like or doctors would like it to be. But
you can certainly smell that fear among some people. I wonder if in a city like ours that isn't in part born of the fact that nature is something that's way over there, and we don't really find ourselves coming into contact with it knowingly very often, and nature is a thing that will rear up and kill us if we look at it the wrong way. Maybe this is urbanism kicking in.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I think that working as a herbalist, it would be much, it's a much more accepted thing in outside of urban areas. Within somewhere like London, it's much more of a sort of retail type of work. You either have all the different Chinese herbalists that, some of which look less kosher than others on the high streets, or it's something that's offered only for very, very particular issues, but it's not something that is much about nature. Although I think that's changing with the urban physic gardens, or with the garden even up here on the South Bank. I think we're recognising that we need to bring nature into the urban environment that way, and connecting people to it more.
And it is all around us anyway, isn't it? In London, I mean, it's such a leafy city, but if you look for it, I mean, you look at the squares, you kind of Russell Square just over the bridge, and then you've got obviously the parks on the fringes of London. You've got these massive cemeteries, these Victorian cemeteries, which have become natural landscapes as well. So I think it's something that's easy to just walk past or not engage with, but it's there, isn't it?
And culturally, what I was saying before as well, whenever I'm in the park and I am sort of foraging, and now foraging has become quite a sort of popular pursuit, and people pay quite a lot of money to go on foraging courses, but it's something that in other cultures, for example closer to home than China, Eastern European cultures, for them going out and foraging for their own berries or mushrooms is a much more commonplace thing that they would have done. And so when I'm in the parks foraging, I always notice the people who look at me and who sort of smile or who then start foraging themselves are generally from those cultures, because it's something that they don't think of as completely weird or a sort of fashion statement, but something that's very much close to home, the idea of just picking berries off a tree and turning it into a tincture.
I think this is possibly where I see the ideas of poetry and herbs coming together, because what you're talking about there, Maria, really is a distillation of some of the very first lessons. I very often think of cave dwellers, our ancestors, having to learn by trial and horrendous error which things were going to polish them off and which ones were good to eat and which ones had various effects. And what you're doing there is a distillation of those first lessons. Right at the beginning, Chris, you mentioned the idea idea of poetry kicking in at fundamental times, and that very primal need for words to fill a void or to deal with a situation. I think there's a connection there. It's all very, very fundamental mm-hmm. on that level. It comes together in Pharma Poetica, which is available now through your publishing company, Pedestrian Publishing.
Yes, you can either get it off our website, which is pedestrianpublishing.com, or because it has an ISBN number, you can order it through any bookstore or ask your local library to order it for you.
And where can we find out more about your herbal practices and your poetry?
I'm published by Salt Publishing, so you find books online. You just put it in Google like everything else these days, and you should get back a Chris McCabe. Hopefully it'll be this one. And Maria's...
And I moonlight as the apothecary's daughter, and I have a website which needs a bit of updating, but it's theapothecary'sdaughter.com.
Well, Maria Vlodi, there's Chris McCabe. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, thank you. My heart aches for some
far off place, no one could have lived. And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Chris McCabe and Maria Vlodideth. Thanks too to Mark Barr and Bernie Barclay. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm Anne Quentin Wolfe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.